Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording in our studio in the East County Wellness Center here in El Cajon. Last week, we interviewed Congresswoman Susan Davis, and today, in the spirit of equal time, we are interviewing her opponent, Republican Larry Wilsk, who is a former Command Master Chief with the Navy SEALs. Larry, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Miriam. It's a pleasure and an honor to be here.
Can you start by telling our listeners why you are running for Congress?
Well, that's an interesting question because I don't think any sane person would wake up one day and say, I want to be in Congress. However, when I was in my last tour of duty teaching at the Senior Enlisted Academy at the Naval War College, I was asked to get into politics for leadership reasons alone. I asked my wife, and we weren't going to stay living in Rhode Island. We moved back home to San Diego, where I'm from, and my wife's from El Cajon, so the idea of another winter of shoveling snow was out. And by the time we got back here, I was approached by some folks that we know and trust, and they asked me to get into politics. So I took a long look at it, and I looked at my own congressional district. And to tell you the truth, I'm very dissatisfied with the leadership there. And there's only two things you can do with a problem: be quiet or get next to it. So with the permission of my wife and friends and support, I said yes to this challenge.
Okay. What do you consider to be the most important issues in the campaign?
Top of the list, and this is from the people whose job I'm applying for, is jobs.
What would you do about jobs?
Well, there's a lot of things to do here. We can expand on jobs, but one of the things we need to focus on is getting three-shift labor back to San Diego. We've had a lot of policies that have made our region a not-too-friendly job environment. We've chased away great opportunities, and we've taken things like NAFTA, which was a great idea, very, very poorly executed.
North American Free Trade Agreement.
Right, and we forgot about it. So we can do quite a bit legislatively at the federal level to create a better environment for jobs, manufacturing, and industry here.
Do you think that NAFTA needs to be repealed or changed, and if changed, how?
I think it needs to be changed, and I think we need to rearrange some of the furniture so we don't take just raw U.S. materials and send them to Mexico for manufacture, assembly, and then distribution worldwide. Doing that, we're not really being competitive. But if we take NAFTA and we just change the wording to manufactured in the U.S., assembled in Mexico, that will make a real big change. The other thing we can do legislatively is support rail going across the border so we can increase the volume of U.S. manufactured goods going into Mexico for assembly and then distribution. And in doing that, we take advantage of Mexican labor rates, U.S. manufacturing skilled labor, and we're competing directly with China. We don't want to rule out China as a trade partner. We want to make them better partners. We do that by competing with them. And we can do that with NAFTA with very little legislative adjustment.
What about national security? I've heard you say that that's also, obviously coming from a Navy SEAL background, very important to you and to America, certainly. What are your views on that?
Well, we've got some policies that have really been frightening Americans, and we've been losing good partners abroad by not having a strong presence. I used to lecture at the War College on the elements of national power, power projection. And in a perfect world, the military option is the least desirable, and it's a last resort, the kinetic option. Mm-hmm. But without a strong last resort and the ability to project that, then diplomacy, our number one resort, won't work that well. Economic support won't work that well, especially when we don't have a good job market here in the United States. Our ability to pass strong information and messaging has been lost lately because the United States is looked at on foreign policy in a lot of areas as a joke. And we need to start resetting some of the relationships we had, and we need to stand a little bit stronger in places. And if we're going to make statements, and an example would be a line in the sand with Syria, well, if you make that statement, we need to stand up to it and live up to it, and we haven't.
That was next on my list, was to ask you about the situation in Syria and Iraq, the threat posed by ISIS and the genocide that's occurring. What do you believe the role of the United States should be in those conflicts?
Well, first let's start where we've got it wrong, because we've created a big part of this problem. When we irresponsibly pulled out of Iraq, we created a vacuum. And we've never done that successfully. Look at World War II. How long did we leave troops in Germany? How long did we leave troops in Japan? Well, they're still there. And keeping a minimal presence of, say, 20,000 troops with good air power would have kept that whole region stabilized. But Syria in itself is a different problem set, and this kind of circles back to Benghazi. The mission in Benghazi was actually funding and arming Syrian rebels to go against Assad. A lot of those rebels that we were financing were ISIS, because they've been around for a long time. So we actually helped develop ISIS into the formidable army they are today. And then because we pulled out of Iraq, there was no force to deal with them.
Yeah, and certainly there's some that would argue this goes all the way back to not only the Obama administration, but the Bush administration before, in launching the war and perhaps fueling that sort of anti-American resentment against some factions in Iraq as well.
Well, this problem set, ISIS, specifically belongs to the Obama administration. There is no backtracking to President Bush. He kept relationships with Syria as best as they could.
So now that we have the situation,
how do we fix it?
Do you support the airstrikes? Do you think that boots on the ground would ever be called for in either of these situations?
There is a road ahead to fix this, and it's not too palatable, but it's not giving you the politically driven answer. Here it is. Mm-hmm. We need to put boots on the ground. We need to have a decisive foreign policy and military policy on this, where our goal isn't just to push ISIS out, it's to eradicate them. They're currently murdering thousands of Christians in heinous ways.
Yeah.
And we can't tolerate that as a country, because if we do, we're inviting every other bad guy on the planet to rear their ugly head and strike while the iron's hot.
Speaking of the Christians that are being massacred, here in East County we have about 40 or 50,000 Iraqi Chaldeans, as well as Kurds and some other displaced minorities from Iraq, who have been trying to get the cap lifted at the federal level to allow more of the persecuted minorities from Iraq, particularly the Christians, to be able to come to this country, many of whom probably would wind up, of course, here. What are your views on that?
I think immediately we should raise anybody in that region that wants to come to the United States to priority one immigration status and allow them to immediately come here. This is our problem to solve. And America's got plenty of resources. We've got plenty of jobs. We can certainly take those folks in, just like we did the refugees from Vietnam.
Let's talk about energy policy. What are your priorities there?
Well, we need to be smarter about energy. And we can do some things here locally that we do everywhere else in the world. For instance, California could be an energy independent economy, a world economy.
Mm-hmm. How would you accomplish that?
Well, there's a few things. And I would use local San Diego technology as part of it. We produce 90% of the oil it would take to make us energy independent, yet we ship 70% of that away. We haven't built a new refinery in 42 years, yet we build refineries worldwide that are clean, efficient, and they work real well. So now, this is one of the things we could do here in San Diego.
Certainly refineries contribute to greenhouse gases, and there are many who are concerned about the impact of greenhouse gases on climate change. Do you believe in climate change? And if so, do you believe that man contributes to that?
Well, first, I'm going to dispute that claim that the refineries that we build internationally are as clean as possible. It's like our natural gas-fired electric plants here in San Diego.
Although they're those clean. Rely on fracked gas, which isn't an issue in San Diego, but certainly in where it
but
comes
from. But the byproducts are the same. The only byproduct that we have in the refineries that we built overseas throughout the Straits of Hormuz in the Middle East, the byproduct's heat, which we could use for heat reclamation and push that into water desalinization. So there is some good byproducts we could have. The greenhouse gas is listed, and if you look at the state of California's cap and trade law, well, three of the top five are naturally occurring gases. Number one is carbon dioxide, which all green plants need. So that scare tactic isn't something that I would even recognize. There's good science behind it, and I would ask everybody that thinks the climate scare isn't real to go talk with John Coleman, who's the foremost meteorologist. He's the guy that created the Weather Channel. He lives here in San Diego. He actually sued Al Gore and won in a gag order to stop him from some of his climate scare tactic arguments. There's a lot of mixed science here, and the whole purpose is politically driving people.
I do need to mention, I think, though, that 98% of the world's climatologists, climate scientists, do agree that climate change is real and that man is either causing or at least contributing to it.
Again, so I would check your resource and say where you get 98%, because that's quite not true.
Well, from the United Nations, for one thing. The United Nations.
And
all
the United
scientists
Nations
who belong to the World,
Climate,
World, Meteorologic, World Meteorological Association.
But the United Nations, as you know and everybody knows, one, it's corrupt. Two, it's a moneymaker. And they certainly haven't supported the United States on a number of different issues. On this one, because it's profitable, they do.
On energy, I would like to know your views on alternative energy, things like solar
Excellent.
And wind, both the pros and cons on that. Certainly in East County, there's a lot of people, even many who do think climate change is an issue, have been experiencing firsthand negative impacts of large wind and solar projects, the negative environmental and in some cases some health impacts and fire dangers that they pose. On the other hand, you know, certainly there's promise for renewable energy in a lot of ways. What are your views on it?
Well, I think we need to have a holistic viewpoint on energy, and a refinery is just a drop in the bucket. There's other things we can do with San Diego-based technology, and we'll get to solar and wind as well, because mm-hmm. you know, the wind doesn't always blow and the sun doesn't always shine.
Mm-hmm.
However, here in San Diego, we've got technology that's been developed here and proven, fourth-generation nuclear technology. Now, we just shut down a 3-gigawatt nuclear power plant.
San Onofre.
We did. But that could have been replaced with a power plant that is 25% of the size that works solely on nuclear waste.
What would you do with the nuclear waste? And what would you do to assure that there's not another Fukushima situation here? Obviously, there was some revelations of utility companies that knew about pipes that were leaking radiation and didn't tell anybody. Doesn't that concern you?
I'll finish that statement mm-hmm. I was making. The fourth generation nuclear power capability that has been developed here in San Diego that works solely on nuclear waste. Normally, nuclear power is more expensive than natural gas. Not much, but more. And it's 100% clean. So now we've got technology that works 60% better utilizing nuclear waste, and it can be cycled through twice, leaving a nuclear waste residual of 3% with a half-life of hundreds of years, not hundreds of thousands of years.
Very interesting.
And that depleted uranium is now weapons grade. So we have 100% use, because we could take that and give it to the military for weapons, depleted uranium munitions. So now we've got 100% use of our nuclear stockpile that we can start driving down, which is a problem set. And that's San Diego-based technology. But there's more San Diego offers in the energy department. And you take a look at ethanol, great example of bad government, because mm-hmm. everybody knows ethanol takes more energy.
Yeah, we saw the food prices going up because they were planting cornfields
right.
for fuel.
Well,
instead
we've
of
got,
food.
Again, San Diego-based companies, locally developed technology for green algae energy fuel.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is when that farm reaches 10,000 acres, everything beyond that is in the black. So it's now producing more energy than it takes in.
So do you support the algae-based fuels?
I do, absolutely. And the kicker here is
Navy, I think, had a green fleet. They were going to sail around the world with this.
Well,
right?
there's
or half algae.
There's more on that. But let me finish, because this is important.
Mm-hmm.
The kicker on this is it doesn't take fresh water. So the immediate available farm that renews through a groundswell is the Salton Sea.
Ah, that's been quite a dilemma of what to do with the Salton Sea out there.
Exactly.
It's basically just drying up and polluted.
But if we take a look at our relationship between San Diego and Tijuana, U.S. and Mexico, if you take a right and go south an hour and a half, you've got hundreds of square miles of unincorporated land that could be immediately flooded by the Sea of Cortez for green algae farming and green algae fuel.
Very interesting concept.
The thing on the Navy, though, and this is, you know, I hope folks understand this, when the Navy went green, the Navy was paying $27 a gallon, is paying $27 a gallon for biofuel.
Yeah, it was subsidized a lot in the early days.
That is such a waste of tax dollars. It's incredible. You know, they should at least pay commercial rates.
Okay. Let's go on. We've got a lot of issues to get through, but
yes,
I'd like
ma'am.
To ask your views on Social Security. Do you believe that Social Security should be protected or changed or privatized, or what are your thoughts on that?
Well, it's part of our culture. And it has been for a few generations now. I don't like the idea that when at one point Social Security was in the black
mm-hmm.
and the trust fund was doing what it was supposed to do. But those greedy people in Congress couldn't see money as not theirs to spend. And it doesn't matter what party you're from, they were all involved in this train wreck.
Yeah.
They drained it back down. Social Security needs to be protected. It is part of our culture. I would, however, like to see folks that have been financially sound have the ability to opt out. It's their money.
So if you're a billionaire, you'd say you don't want it. You can let the government keep it and use it for those who need it.
Or they could get their money back. Either way. It's not a billionaire-millionaire thing. And this is one of those things to where – and that's a policy driven by this administration I disagree with, is using envy to drive politics. If somebody has a lot of money, it's probably because they worked real hard and earned it, most folks. And if somebody wants their money that they invested in the government without their choice back, so be it. And if they want to leave it there because they can afford to, that should be their choice, not mandated by an emotional election cycle.
Let's talk about immigration and border security. What are your views on those two issues?
And glad you asked. Yeah. And they are two issues. I'm glad you laid it out that way.
So you're not one that says we have to have the world's firmest border before we can address the immigration issue.
I actually had the honor to chair the annual border security summit this year here in San Diego, where all four border states, all the federal agencies, all the contractors and the manufacturers that support border security were there. And we all agreed on a couple of things. And one of them is that San Diego has a secure border. We've got as pretty good a secure border as you can get, and it's not just because of a fence.
Yeah, and immigration has certainly gone down, undocumented immigration, we should say.
Well, it's illegal. I mean, call it what it is. And the thing is, the reason we've got a secure border in San Diego, the fence helps, but it's because of the relationship we've got between San Diego and Tijuana.
Mm-hmm.
And economically, over the last, say, 100 years, when there's been a good economy in San Diego, there's a good economy in Tijuana. And that relationship, coupled with about 150,000 families that straddle the border, make it a secure border. The problem is it's not a fluid border, and it's not commercially as sound as it could be. Right now, we get about $20 million of commerce and trade going back and forth across the border.
Mm-hmm.
That could be about $2 to $3 million a minute if we work it right and bring industry here and take advantage of that relationship. Sadly, the other three border states and part of our own state don't have that relationship. So the kicker is, how do we create political will to secure the border? And that's what everybody at that border security summit complained about. There's no political will to actually secure the border, because once you have a secure and fluid and working border, then you can really take a look at the immigration issue sets. You know, and that's part of it.
What are your views on immigration reform? What would you say to the many, many people who have come here who are living in the shadows, including, I might add, the Dreamers, the Dream Act, the ones that were brought here as children? What would your views be on that?
This is where I and the far right don't necessarily line up, and I have no problem with that.
Mm-hmm.
I was on the Navy parachute team some years ago, and we got to do a demonstration to jump onto the Statue of Liberty. Not on the statue itself, but right in front of it.
Mm.
And I read that plaque, and it means a lot to me.
Yeah.
And who does our country open our arms to?
You're tired, you're poor, you're huddled masses.
Right. Now, when people come here with sweat and blood and calluses as their only entrepreneurial equity, well, we need to respect that. The problem with the Mexican border, and it's the Mexican border, is our number one problem, should be our number one priority,
mm-hmm.
is our State Department is not invigorated to work with Mexico and have them uphold their immigration laws. Again, once we secure the border, we get the State Department in gear, and if we need to rearrange that treaty, we do. Now, on the other side of that is we have, the reported number of illegal aliens here is about 11 million. My guess would be more like 20.
Mm-hmm.
There are nefarious characters there. They need to be exported immediately and not in a friendly manner. They came here for our country to sell drugs, commit crime. The human trafficking problem set is part of that as well. And those are awful human beings that need to be tossed out or prosecuted to the fullest extent. Those people that have been living here, like you call them the Dream Act folks.
Yeah, it's kind of two categories. There's the Dreamers, the people who were brought here as children, and then you have the
categories.
People who came here as adults but have nonetheless been here many years.
Well, if they're here, they should not have access to our social services if they're not here legally.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think once we secure the border, we can take a good look and focus on that and get people a reasonable alignment to citizenship that precludes those social services, because that is a huge expense that we can't afford.
Susan Davis said that if you took the people who were living in the shadows, not the criminals, but the ones who have been here working hard, but who in many cases are not paying taxes, if they were legalized and paid into the system, that would actually help the economy, the budget, because all of a sudden you'd be having people paying into the Social Security system, for example, all these people that are out here working in the shadows right now. What are your views on that?
Well, I think Susan Davis is prying a good emotional argument and not going after the problem. And the problem are the people that employ them. You know, employers need to employ legal people, withhold taxes, and pay into the system. Legalizing people that are hardworking and want to be part of our country and assimilate into our society, that's a different problem set. And we need to address both as different and not use one to emotionally garner support for the other. And I think it's important that we go after people that have businesses that are paying sub-minimum wage, not collecting taxes, and illegally employing people for their own selfish benefit. And those folks need to be prosecuted and found out.
Let's talk about women's issues next.
Sure.
Specifically, I'd like to ask you about a couple of different aspects of women's issues. One of them would be the Fair Pay for Women Act, which actually had a lot of Republican opposition in Congress. What are your views on that?
Okay, I'm not completely studied or familiar with that particular legislation. However, my background in the military is pretty straightforward. A pay grade gets a paycheck, and it's gender neutral. You don't care.
Okay.
And I think that's fair. And everybody in different pay grades should have, the same paycheck. If they're a man or a woman and they're doing the same job, then they're a man or a woman. They're doing the same job. They should get the same pay. The interesting piece of this, and this is where I talked about leadership before in our district and where I was disappointed. Because if Susan Davis was doing a good job, I wouldn't be sitting here. She should stand up as a leader on this. And where she talks about equal pay for women, why isn't she standing on the tallest mountaintop screaming bloody murder at this administration for having such a high disparity in women's pay?
Within the administration staffing, you mean?
Within the administration staff itself, okay. There is a huge disparity in men and women's pay. You know, that needs to be drawn out in public eye. If somebody's doing a good job, they get the same pay.
Let's talk about birth control and abortion, which have been two mm-hmm. hot-button issues right now. Are you pro-choice or pro-life, or is there a nuanced position somewhere in between those
two?
Well,
there's a different way to look at it. I look at it this way. Legally and constitutionally, everybody in our country is pro-choice. I would choose life, personally. And we need to quit vilifying people on this, because in every abortion, there's two victims. There are, no matter what. And first and foremost, abortion isn't a good thing. So when I see people like Debbie Wasserman Schultz jumping up and down screaming triumph over late-term abortion, well, that's kind of criminal, because it's not a good thing. I think we need to be a much better bunch of leaders in Congress on talking about birth control and abortion prevention and, abortion alternatives, mm-hmm. like adoption and like birth control, or talking to kids and making families involved in this whole educational process on childbirth and planning children instead of just having them. This is a holistic thing we need to come together on, and the number one thing that we need to incorporate here is compassion. And compassion for a young mother, mm-hmm. compassion for an unborn child, because let's face it, we use one thing to determine death, and that's a heartbeat. And why don't we use that to determine life is beyond me. And the things that we call late-term abortion, where you have a survivable baby that's aborted, well, to me, that's just plain murder.
What about the earlier-term abortions? And do you believe that abortion should remain safe and legal in all circumstances, some circumstances? Can you be very specific on that one, please?
Well, like I said, I would choose life.
So does that mean that if somebody's raped?
And again, this is where we try and take – this is where I don't like politics, mm-hmm. because they'll take that sliver of 0.1% rape abortion and try and make sweeping legislation based on that emotional draw, and that's unfair to everybody. First and foremost, abortion is much more of a woman's issue than a man's issue. After all, I don't get pregnant.
That's true.
You know, our job in pregnancy is to be supportive, because regardless of what modern nouveau people say, we don't get pregnant. She gets pregnant. We have to help out. So there is some lopsided choice in this one, leaning towards the women's choice. But I think abortion should be avoided. And 3,000 a day is a disaster. It's a disaster for our culture.
Avoided and made illegal, though. So, for example, Congressman Hunter introduced a bill that had it passed, would have outlawed all abortion, even when the life of the mother was in danger, even if a woman was raped, even if it was an incest
victim. Roe versus Wade was done 42 years ago?
Yeah.
Okay. A lot of smart people have tried to overturn it since. Mm-hmm. I'm not smart enough, and I'm not even going to address it. It's the law of the land, but we need to make it a better law, and we need to make our society a better and more compassionate society.
So you would like to see abortion be safe and legal, but rare, basically, in an ideal world?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Very rare.
Okay.
Avoidable at all costs. But you know what? Not at the expense of people's lives, because abortion scars folks.
Okay. What are your views on education?
Well, it's locally and federally. First and foremost, I think the federal government has no business being in local education. And because the federal government has asserted itself and created this huge bureaucracy, we've got train wrecks like Common Core standards that don't even teach children civics. There's no civics requirement to graduate high school. Mm-hmm. $70 billion a year is the Department of Education's budget for staffing. I think that money would be much better served at the local community level. Now, being, you know, parochially speaking from San Diego, I've watched our high schools get gutted from vocational training. And this notion, and Mrs. Davis is a proponent of this, and this notion that everybody needs to go to college is nonsense. The military's got a real good example of about 15 to 20% of the people should go to college. The rest need a job and a trade and a road ahead so they can live the American dream.
So you would support more vocational training and maybe not addressing things like the high cost of college?
Well, I would take that money from the federal government, give it to the state and local governments, and let neighborhoods, principals, and school board members sort out how they develop their children instead of having a mandate come from the federal government.
Okay. Certainly one of the most important things that the Obama administration did, if you were to ask them, would be the passage of the Affordable Health Care Act. It's also been one of the most controversial. What are your views on the Affordable Health Care Act? Do you support keeping it, repealing it, or changing it? And if changing it, what would those changes be?
Well, I firmly believe it needs to be tossed out in its entirety and then take a look at the problems that it was originally marketed on. Because, you know, this 15,000-page disaster that Susan Davis did not read before she signed. In fact, most of Congress irresponsibly didn't read it. And it was created in a vacuum behind closed doors. Well, that's being irresponsible across the boards. And that's our president not living up to his promise of transparency or any of the members of Congress. This was an attack and a cash cow for insurance companies. However, if you look at the things it was marketed on, people that want to change insurance companies with pre-existing conditions, they don't want to be penalized for it. Okay, that's reasonable. Insuring people that can't get insurance, can't afford it. Okay, we should backstop those folks. They're our fellow Americans. Mm-hmm. Or people that don't want insurance, you know, the invincible 20-somethings that you can get by with catastrophic health care. Well, the math on supporting that very small percentage of our population is an expense of $140 to $160 million a year, which is a far cry from this trillion-dollar job-killing train wreck mm-hmm. called the Affordable Care Act.
So if you rolled it back, what would you do to try to assure health care for, say, you know, the poor who couldn't afford it before this came along, recognizing that there certainly have been some problems with it? But what would you do for those folks, or do you think that should be a free market thing?
Well, obviously, I'm a free market person, so I would think free market. However, those people you're specifically talking about have been affected here in San Diego through a lack of tort reform. When I was a kid growing up, and I didn't live in a, you know, always in a great neighborhood, we had a free clinic where you could go. And there would be interns there or volunteer doctors or a lot of folks in the healthcare industry that would go on their own time to help out neighborhoods. Well, we've become so litigious in nature that we've sued them right off of our streets. And I think we need to have a little bit of tort reform, which comes down to something along the lines of loser pays, to discourage frivolous lawsuits that have taken good things like local free clinics off the streets. Get those back. And then take a look at those people that can't afford health insurance, and we can subsidize those, because if they can't afford health insurance, they're probably on some sort of a state aid or welfare. And if they're qualifying there, we should be able to give them some health care. And with caveat, with a path to standing on their own two feet and affording their own health care.
Okay. You are a veteran. We are seeing veterans coming back with very high rates of suicide, PTSD, in some cases, you know, long waits for treatment for things like traumatic brain injuries and so forth. What more, if you were in Congress, would you want to do for our veterans and our military families that hasn't already been done? Where are the needs?
One of the things, and we could go right to the Veterans Administration, because as a disabled vet, I get all of my medical treatment through the VA. So the VA is a great starting point, and the Affordable Care Act caused this problem specifically.
Although some would say that the VA is socialized medicine in a sense, that it's government-run healthcare.
All military medicine is, and that's what we do when we sign up, because we, again, in the military, you don't sign up to be part of a democracy. You sign up to protect one,
right?
A republic. The VA, so the Affordable Care Act happened. 8 million people lost their health care overnight. Every veteran out there, a lot of them flipped out. And what they did is they went back to be reevaluated to have their disability rating increased, or in hopes that it would increase, to backstop their losing their health insurance. That clobbered the system. Mm. The VA is armed, trained, and equipped to handle the medical staffing requirements that it had before the Affordable Care Act. This came in, clobbered the system. Then Congress did what, you know, out-of-touch congressional people do. They threw money at the problem. And then they hired General Shinseki based on political leanings. He'd already been fired from the Army. He wasn't a proven good leader. They put him in charge, and he started throwing money at problems that was not inspectable. So immediately, what we need to do with the VA, one, mandate that anybody that calls the VA for an appointment that can't get one within 72 hours, it's immediately outsourced to a local doctor.
Ah, there's an interesting idea.
And then give them the option to keep that local doctor. One, because of the bureaucracy in the VA, that direct funding will actually save money. And we can start outsourcing until the VA is back in balance again.
Yeah. I would like to talk to you, speaking of money, about some of the issues over the government shutdown. We've had, obviously, a very big partisan divide in Congress in the last couple of years that led to the shutdown of the government. Do you believe that there are principles worth standing on that are worth shutting the government down, or do you believe that to avoid that, that whether you agree or disagree with whatever party is in power or whatever administration is in power, should there be compromise to assure that the government continues to be funded and that we don't have another shutdown?
Well, as you know, the government didn't really shut down. They took away key proponents that would politically hurt people's feelings and make our country more vulnerable. And it was really used, and it wasn't executed well. Congress all kept their paychecks. The president kept his paycheck. He still kept his, you know, large vacation fund and executed it during that shutdown period.
True. Although, speaking of vacations, there were people who couldn't go to the national parks. They had their vacations canceled.
Right.
We had issues of no air traffic controllers here for the fire tower.
They took it away where
Ramona.
It would hurt the most, and that was reprehensible. I don't think for one second anybody in Congress shouldn't be able to balance their checkbook like you and I have to. And this idea of a government shutdown looming, no. The Constitution is very clear on what the job of Congress is. The problem is they haven't prioritized based on Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. They prioritize based on political leanings and the political tide and emotional things they can do to win elections. And that's across the boards. That's Democrats, Republicans alike. If they can't balance their budget, even submit one, and live up to it, they should be sacked.
The other foreign policy issue that's been in the news quite a bit in the last few days and weeks is Israel, the Israel-Palestinian situation. What are your views on that?
Well, this is pretty interesting because Israel is our number one ally in the Middle East. They are our friends. They are leaders. Their culture is very similar to ours. We have got to support them, not blindly, but 100%. And if you look at Hamas in Palestine, the people there allow them to hide in the open. We have a lot of mechanisms, both in our information capabilities and military capabilities and humanitarian capabilities, we can do to help motivate the Palestinian people not to allow Hamas to hide in the open, terrorists. Mm-hmm. And the last thing we should do is one of the things our Secretary of State's doing is giving Hamas hundreds of millions of dollars, you know, news this week. We've got to knock that off. The leadership that we need to support and bolster and stand shoulder to shoulder with is Netanyahu, Israel, dealing with that whole situation. Because I would probably be a little more heavy-handed than he is. They struck Hamas targets in Palestine on a Thursday. Saturday, 150 trucks from Israel are going in with humanitarian aid to help those neighborhoods out because innocent people were lost. because they allowed the enemy to hide in the open. We can't forget Israel. And to tell you the truth, our president has been so disrespectful. I can't for the life of me understand why Susan Davis isn't standing on the tallest mountaintop screaming at this administration to support our number one ally in the Middle East. That's a lack of leadership.
Is there anything else that I haven't specifically asked you about that you would like our listeners to know, Larry?
Well, there are some things that have got and this is interesting. There are some indirect racism going on in the federal government. And I'm not saying racism out of intent. I'm saying out of results.
Can you give an example?
Sure. Gun control. There was sweeping gun control. And I'll use the example of Chicago and Washington, D.C. In 2012, there were sweeping gun control laws by a lot of people that were convinced guns kill people, people don't kill people. Well, in Washington, D.C., the sweeping gun control laws made no difference in gun crime. Didn't go up, didn't go down. So if you look at Washington, D.C., they've got a very high rate of per capita police officers. And the inner city minority families in Washington, D.C. make more money than Chicago. In Chicago, sweeping gun control laws went into place. Who paid the price? Inner city black families' death rates from gun violence went up. And it's real simple. When you legislate or you put in restrictions, it costs more. So, you know, rich people in Washington that legislate gun control, they can still afford to go buy a gun. They can still afford to go buy security if they need it. They can afford anything. They have no idea that law-abiding poor family inner city Chicago can no longer go get a gun because it's unaffordable, can't protect their home.
On the issue of guns and guns control, the flip side of that argument would be we've seen mass school shootings and things like that.
Sure.
What would be your solution?
Look at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Connecticut, for instance. Now, Sandy Hook Elementary, this is a problem with groupthink, and it kills. And that's been proven time and time again. Sandy Hook, out of all good intentions, put a big target on their school when they said gun-free zone, which is an invitation for any kook and nut job out there to come kill. Now imagine if, at Sandy Hook Elementary School, if one of the two first people that engaged that crazy kid, which was the principal and vice principal, both women, one murdered, the other one shot, if either one of them had trained, there's a breakaway holster, purse holster, and a pistol that were able to engage that guy, how many lives might have been saved?
So you think there should be guns in the classrooms where teachers
have
guns?
What I think teachers should have the option to do, and I think school administration should have the option to do, is actually pay teachers a stipend to go through adequate training with their local law enforcement, local precinct cops, and get their concealed carry weapons. So a school, instead of saying, we're gun-free, any nut job can come here and be successful, they could have a sign up to say, our teachers may be armed and able to protect the children inside these walls.
Okay. Larry, we are out of time for today, but I want to thank you so much for joining us. Listeners, if you tuned in late, we have been speaking with Larry Wilsky, who is the Republican candidate running against Susan Davis in the 53rd Congressional District. Larry, where can people get more information about you and your candidacy?
First, thanks for having me. And folks, you can go to www.wilskyforcongress.com.
Okay. Thank you so much for joining us today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ.